last round of investigation of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi song for a while, maybe. We're up to outwardly still while inwardly moving, like a tethered colt, a trapped rat. Or outwardly tranquil while inwardly agitated, like a tethered colt, or a hidden mole, like a ground squirrel. These are all translations, these characters. So, remember the illumination hexagram, the Soto Zen hexagram made up of these two trigrams, equal trigrams, that are a yin surrounded by two yangs, right? A split line surrounded by two solid lines. And we talked about how that could be seen as like a receptive, non-doing, feminine interior surrounded by an active, strict, masculine exterior. Remember that? Mm-hmm. So, and you could say that's the dual mirror trigram. That's an image for this mirror awareness. We could say that this line is about the opposite type of trigram, where you have an active, even agitated interior surrounded by a tranquil, cool exterior. A solid line surrounded by two dashed lines. So kind of like the opposite of dual mirror awareness. Can you picture such an image? So outwardly still, you know, as opposed to, we're in the middle of the, I think the dual mirror awareness is we could be in the middle of a very chaotic situation, outwardly very involved and active, but inwardly just receptive and still, just like a mirror. The mirror is at the center, and the active reflections are surrounding it. And this line would be talking about when we lose the dual mirror. I think it's implying when we've lost the dual mirror, we can be sitting zazen, very still. Outwardly, we're cool, but inwardly we're trembling and agitated, like a tethered colt, a hidden mole, a trapped rat, like a tethered colt, like our life energy is being like tied down. There's a Zen phrase of donkey tethering stake. Don't make Dharma and teachings and understandings into a donkey tethering stake, meaning like don't pick up a wonderful free Dharma like the Jewel Mirror Samadhi and try to get a hold of it and then tie ourselves down to it like we're tied to a post. We're like young cults wanting to express our life energy, and any even great teachings can be like can tie us down if we grasp them conceptually. So this would be another nuance here. It would be like if we're grasping the dual mirror awareness in some fixed conceptual way, and like a hidden mole. I think a nice image compared to a trapped rat has maybe like a rat in a maze kind of image, but hidden mole is kind of like We're like down in the hole underground, and like we don't want to come out and face the world. This could be like a kind of like stagnant meditation. We're relying on the stillness, the external stillness. We're kind of hiding in zazen, and in the quiet serenity of the form of zazen, outwardly still, but inwardly we're moving, and we don't want to engage in the world. All these are kind of nuances I kind of hear in this line. Like a tethered, outwardly still while inwardly moving, like a tethered, cold, trapped rat. Such people like us, when we're in that situation, where there's a little bit of internal fear from holding on inside, then the ancient sages pity them and bestowed upon them the teaching. Really, that compassion, that character for pity is compassion. The ancient sages had compassion for them. Maybe a little better than pity them, I think. It's the he of like the Dahi Shindarani. Ancient sages had compassion for them, and then these next lines, Dharma, and the characters for Dana Paramita. Bestowed upon them the teaching is more literally, you know, I think that's what that's what Dana Paramita of Dharma means, but literally it's like Dharma, Dana Paramita. And as you may have heard, when we're talking about the paramitas and the perfection of giving, giving usually includes there's three types of giving: material gifts, Dharma gift, and the gift of fearlessness or protection from fear. And similarly, based on this old teaching of these types of giving, our Bodhisattva precept of not being possessive. Literally, the precept says not being possessive of material things and Dharma things. So we want to give materially, we want to give Dharma, not be possessive of material, not be possessive of Dharma. And so in this case, it's the ancient sages had compassion for them, and practiced Dana Paramita with the Dharma. You could maybe translate it kind of literally like that. They gave these hiding moles some Dharma, because these people, maybe like us, according to their delusions, they call black as white, or according to their inverted views, it's the same character as in the Heart Sutra. How does that line go? Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. And I think the Heart Sutra is implying inverted views of taking things to be not empty, taking things to be substantial. Heart Sutra's theme. And we could say the same here. But particularly here, the inverted views, they call black as white. And, you know, you could just take it symbolically, like we understand the opposite of what's happening. But black and white are big images in this dual mirror samadhi, right? So you could hear it as they take the ultimate, the black, as the relative, the white, or vice versa. It's kind of unusual characters that are used for black and white, but maybe for poetic sense. And is it? Yep, it's the rhyming character. So it's got a rhyme. So Dungshan maybe sometimes chooses obscure characters to make them rhyme. The end of each four character line is a rhyming character. Just so where, as the Chinese down here, all these four-line verses, the end of each four-line verse, I think each... it can't be. It must be the end of every eight, where there's like these pairs of four-line verses, every eight lines. That would be too many to rhyme, you know, like 100 different lines. But it's like half of them. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, because I can see some of them aren't the same here. But I think the right-hand column, just these two columns, the very right-hand character in each one rhymes in Chinese, not necessarily in Japanese form. Well, the meaning is what we're getting into here. Mm-hmm. The meaning, of course, is not in words. Yeah. But as you know, I've pointed out in several places, there are these couplets where, or like characters that repeat again and again. But I think it's a very, I don't understand Chinese poetry so much, but I think it's not some kind of complex rhyme scheme. It's just that as you look at it, in the Chinese version, it's just that, you know, so the other characters don't rhyme. It's just, and maybe if you're chanting it like that and each one is one syllable, you might get that sense of the rhyme when reading it. Again, I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But that, I think that's part of the, there's some speculation on why did he say it this way? Especially if it's the character in the right-hand column, he maybe stretched a bit in terms of the meaning to make it rhyme. Which is why maybe it's an unusual character for, it's not the usual character for white, but it does mean white, but it's an unusual one. When erroneous imagination cease, and as you can see in the Chinese there, it's the same characters as delusions, or more literally, inverted views from the line above. There's two characters in the line above that, you know, the third and the fourth are the same as the first and the second in this line. So things like that are, you know, there's this repetition, and earlier we had this whole stream of repetition about, embracing the road, embracing the territory, and so on. So when erroneous imaginations or inverted views and conceptions, the third character there is the one that's used to translate the third skanda, samnya, which we say perceptions in our Heart Sutra, but if I had to choose one word, I think conceptions is a little more accurate. It really implies conceptual thought, samnya. So you could say, when inverted views and conceptual thought cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. Acquiescent, maybe okay. It also means like the willing or accepting mind, which I think is a very nice way to put it, because that's that inner receptive split line, right? That yin line is like accepting, willing. So the mind of acceptance realizes itself, or the willingness, the mind of willingness is naturally realized. Realizes itself, you could also translate naturally realized. So this is pretty straightforward now, I think. Zen stuff. following along, we're still just, of course, talking about the dual mirror samadhi. Dual mirror samadhi is when the inverted views that like don't see the world of experience as just reflections on the mirror, but that it's like really like an assault to us. It's crushing us down rather than just resting on our dual mirror mind. with that kind of inverted view, when that ceases, then you could say then the reflections just rest on the mirror, and the accepting mind, the mirror that accepts all the images, naturally realizes itself. If you want to conform to the ancient way, please observe the sages of former times.
Can we go back to you?
Yes, yes.
What other Zen terms are used for that realizes itself? I mean,
yeah, realizes, it's not the usual, it's an unusual character for realize compared to Dogen's often talking about realization. It's not the same as that. And itself is literally the character for self, which just like in English, can mean kind of like naturally, like self-fulfilling, like a self-fulfilling prophecy is naturally fulfilling.
Is it connected to self-fulfilling samadhi?
It's the same self character, but it's not the same. I mean, that is a common character, G, of GGU, self. And interestingly, the one that it's being translated here as realizes, it's actually similar to the character that Dogen uses for like verification, show, but it's it means other translations here are allow. So you could say the willing mind is naturally allowed, or permitted, or acknowledged, authorized, self-authorized, maybe allowed or permitted is more like the literal meaning. So when these inverted views cease, the willing mind or the accepting mind permits itself, could even say, permits itself or acknowledges itself. I mean, other meanings that are, I think, a little bit different are forgive. You could say that the accepting mind forgives itself of all its delusions. You know, you can... I think that's probably not a dominant translation here, but that's the way Chinese is, yeah, pretty dynamic. But yeah, it's a character that doesn't seem to pop up too much in Dogen and so on. Again, it's a rhyming character, right? There, it's the end of the eight character line.
Question about that same idea of realization. If it's extended away beyond us into the universe, what I'm hearing is...
What's extended beyond us?
If this idea of self-realization...
Uh-huh.
I'm picturing a universe that's A, conscious, and B, aware of itself. If we can be that way, then the whole universe is that way. Somehow there's this entity, this totality, that's conscious and self-aware. That sounds like a context we're talking about, and that interests me.
I think, according to Buddha Dharma, we wouldn't project that there's an external universe that has a mind of its own, almost like a like it's a conscious universe apart from us. So I think the way we can talk about it in terms of Buddha Dharma, that's similar to I think what you're saying, is the mind only view, that actually the universe is mind. In a way co-created by all of our mental projections in an inconceivable way. But maybe from the most simple point of view, just from our own personal experience, it's our universe. There's no universe for us. There is no universe apart from our mind, right? That's pretty straightforward. Although unusual. We don't usually think that way. But it's almost undeniable that I think we'd say, well, you know, in terms of our experience throughout our entire life, any universe that we know of is only our universe. And in that way, it's conscious, or it's not exactly that it's conscious of us. It's more like it is made of mind in a way, because it's conceptual imputation coming from our side. So that's why we say, like, you know, it's maybe traditionally it would be said, like, inanimate things don't have Buddha nature out there, that they actually are going to become a Buddha. But because we're experiencing them and we have Buddha nature, because as sentient beings we have Buddha nature, it has to do with the nature of awareness is Buddha nature. Then in that way, our Buddha nature can manifest as rocks, tiles, and pebbles, and so on. And in that way we can say they have Buddha nature, or they are Buddha nature. That's maybe a kind of more logical way of talking about Dogen's all being is Buddha nature, without getting into kind of some cosmic imagination, metaphysical speculations. And in quite a straightforward, even I would say logical way, our Buddha nature, in other words, the nature of our mind, is all Buddha nature is, the empty, aware nature of our mind, actually manifests as a bunch of delusions and conceptuality and the projection of external rocks and tiles and so on. They're not actually out there. Since they're projections of our mind, the essence of them, the true nature of those projected rocks and pebbles, the true nature of them, we could say, is Buddha nature coming from us. I don't know if we talked about this earlier in the Buddha nature class. And you know, I don't know if that's the kind of classical understanding, but to me, that's a way that I can really embrace Dogen's view and the Zen proposal that all being inanimate and animate is Buddha nature. Could y'all follow that?
Mm-hmm. There's a sense of reflection there, just like a mirror. I don't know if you use the word manifesting, if we are manifesting the Buddha nature of the object,
yep.
We are a mirror. We are acting as a mirror of our own nature.
And what's being reflected in the mirror?
Our own nature.
As rocks and tiles and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's the thing.
Where the surface of the mirror is, but it's there somewhere.
I think this is an interesting point too about where the mirror metaphor that we're obviously really into now is the nature of our mind, and it's reflecting all these images. And now we're bringing in the aspect that these images that are reflected in it are actually coming from our side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're not actually, unlike a physical mirror where you put an object out there in front of it, we start to, if we look closely from a certain perspective, it's that the projected images are actually not so much coming from outside and being reflected on the mirror, but they're almost like emerging from the mirror itself. They're coming from behind the mirror. It's like this is kind of a trick mirror. We look and like, where's the image reflected? And we turn around from the mirror, look for the rock, and it's not actually there, it's just the reflection. Well, if there's no rock outside the mirror, where did that reflection come from? And we see, in a way, it came forth from the mirror. I mean, I'm messing with the metaphor now. But it seems that's how it is. That there's if the nature of mind is the mirror awareness, and then what are all these objects out here? They're like the nature of awareness manifesting as form and objects that aren't really out there, but they manifest as appearances of external objects. The images come from the mirror, special kind of mirror, ordinary kind of mirror. If you want to conform, so, you know, I think generally, you know, people like us are really into, like, conforming. Yeah, conform isn't such a nice word. I think that I don't think it's the best translation either. It's really more like join or agree. If you want to join the ancient way, or if you want to join the ancient precedents, would be more literal.
Accord.
Mm-hmm. If you want to accord. Harmonize mm-hmm. works. There's a nice thing about that character. If you look at that, it's the second from the left on that line. That character that has a little like roof and then a line and then a square, right? When you might have this on. I don't know if it's always done on Keti Myaku, the lineage papers that you get at Jukai. Sometimes Tenshin Roshi will do this on the place where it folds over, the paper folds over. You see there's that character doubled. So it's like, and without getting too involved in the secret workings of Dharma transmission ceremonies, I can think I can tell you this much because it's a very beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. It's not about the meaning of the documents, but when you finally kind of seal the documents, this where the flap goes over, the teacher takes the brush and does one line like this. And then they give the brush to the student. The student does a line the other way, so it's an X. And then, see that how the X is actually two Vs touching, like arrow points? Then, like, in that V, that's the V of this character. And then the teacher draws the line and the square, and they give the brush. They're sitting across from the table, across from each other at the table. And then they do the line and the square, so it's the two characters, one's upside down, they're facing each other. Can you see when you look at that character, how it's like that? So it looks kind of like an X with a square on each side of it, but it's really like meeting or according, and then according, yeah? And you actually like kind of like draw the characters together, piece at a time, and that's the place where the flap of the document meets. Is the place where the teacher and the student meet and kind of seal it all together. So, but even on the Jukai Tenshin Roshi's, I have one that he's just done by himself in that according, meeting, agreeing character. So if you want to agree with the ancient precedents, please observe the ancients. It doesn't really say sages. You can see the ancient characters in each line. The word precedence is interesting because it also means like the wagon wheel tracks. The character has the radical for wheel in it, so it's literally like wheel tracks means ancient precedence, like the Buddha's footsteps. You could even say, like we can't. The sages, the ancient Zen ancestors are gone, but their wheel tracks are like here, right? So you can roll along in the jewel mirror samadhi that they left behind. And it's a little bit like saying, you know, like the Sandokai says, don't make up standards on your own. A similar feeling of like, well, you know, these ancients have left us such great wisdom. Just look to that for guidance. I think of that. I don't know if you've seen that movie, Amongst White Clouds, about the Chinese hermits. It's a kind of documentary on Chinese Zen hermits in modern times. They interview them. Beautiful, beautiful movie. Amongst White Clouds. It's a young American man who wants to go find the Chinese hermits, so he does, in the deep mountains, and with his video camera and microphone, and learns Chinese and tracks them down. And we've watched it here, I think. On one of our movie nights, we could do it again. But I just thought of now that one of those hermits, the one that like kind of at the end of the story, they're like, this is the guy who the other hermits say he's right on the verge of Buddhahood. He's like at the very end of his journey, and he's they finally, you know, they like knock on his door, nobody's there, his little hut in the mountains, and they camp out there, and they're going to go back the next day, and then it turns out he comes out the next day, and he's just very quiet, but very kind. Then he invites him in for tea, and and they're trying to interview him, and he basically like, he's like, I have nothing to say. I don't know anything. But you're like the greatest master in all of China, they say. And he says like, if you want to know the practice, just read the sutras. He says, it's all in there. The sutras, it's like these kind of, this is interesting for a Zen person, you know, because they're sort of like outside the sutras. So he's like, that's the whole instruction manual. It's all right there. You just follow it. Don't ask me. Here's the book. Kind of like the wagon wheel ruts from the ancient times. When about to fulfill or complete the way of Buddhahood, the Buddha way, one gazed at a tree for 10 eons, or kalpas. Now, it does just say, like, the character for gaze is, also means contemplate. It's the character that's used for vipassana in Chinese. So, you know, we're not sure, I don't think, exactly what this is, but I wouldn't have said gazed at a tree. I mean, there is the story of the Buddha right after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. In the old sutras, they say he sat there and actually, like, he sat under that tree for a while, and then he, like, went and sat under another tree. And if you go to Bodh Gaya, they're probably not the actual trees, but there are these different trees, and for each of the 7 weeks, they're like, this is the tree where Buddha sat for the second week. It's like, you know, a couple hundred yards away from the first tree. And they say, in the sutras, he sat under that tree and he gazed at the Bodhi tree, almost like, that tree helped me. And like, it's so beautiful. I don't know, there's no explanation. So it could be like he gazed at the tree, but I think we might be able to translate that. Like about to fulfill the way of Buddhahood, one contemplated at the tree. I think it is referring to the Bodhi tree in any case, but contemplated under the tree. you know, at the tree. Practice vipassana or insight at the tree for 10 eons. And so this refers to this story in the Lotus Sutra. Chapter 7 of the Lotus Sutra, and it is about this Buddha. The Shakyamuni Buddha is talking about this ancient Buddha who sat down and was about to realize Buddhahood, and all these flowers started raining on him from the devas and so on. But then he just kept sitting there, and more flowers would rain, and then they would blow away, and more flowers would rain, and they kept venerating him for 10 kalpas, right? Like, in one kalpa is inconceivably long time, but for 10 of them, he just kept sitting there, not realizing Buddhahood. And then in the sutra, he eventually does. You can read that story, but it became this kind of like, Zen people picked up on that story. They thought that was neat. Somebody sat under this tree for 10 eons. Not Shakyamuni Buddha, but this other Buddha. So it's, I think, case 9 in the Mumon Kan is about this Buddha. Why didn't he realize Buddhahood if he sat after sitting for 10 eons?
How did he live that long?
It's miraculous, mysterious.
It was amazing.
His samadhi was so deep that, you know, we have these stories about the devas feeding these meditators through the pores of their skin and so on. I don't know. But we have that. There's some other teacher in the Mumon Kan. Monk asks him why he didn't realize Buddhahood. And here's somebody asked Linji, the record of Linji, section 22. Someone said, the great universal wisdom excellence Buddha, that was his name, sat in the place of practice for 10 eons, 10 kalpas, but the Dharma of the Buddhas did not appear before him, and he was unable to complete the Buddha way. That's the sutra. And then the monk says, I don't understand what this means. Would you please be kind enough to explain it? Linji, Rinzai. And Linji then says what, you know, his interpretation of what all these words mean. I won't bring you the whole thing, but basically, he says, the Dharma of the Buddhas failing to appear before his eyes refers to the fact that the Buddha by nature is not subject to birth, and the Dharma by nature is not subject to extinction. How then could it be the kind of thing that appears before one? So he's kind of playing with, I don't think, in the Lotus Sutra, I don't think this is exactly the meaning. This is the Zen people playing with this story and saying, well, the Dharma didn't appear to him because the Dharma doesn't appear. In the Lotus Sutra, I think it says, at some point it does appear. But here, Linji says, the Dharma isn't born and doesn't die, how could it appear before anyone? As for being unable to complete the Buddha way, the Buddha doesn't need to do anything to make him a Buddha. Somebody in ancient times said, the Buddha is eternally in this world, but is not stained by the things of this world. Followers of the way, if you want to attain Buddhahood, don't chase around after the 10,000 things. When mind arises, various kinds of things arise. When mind is extinguished, various kinds of things are extinguished. This probably sounds familiar. So, the Zen take, which could be, Linji was a contemporary of Dongshan. It seemed to be in the Zen school already that people picked up on that section of the Lotus Sutra and talked about this. When about to fulfill the way of Buddhahood, one contemplated at the tree for 10 eons, like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray. So you could also hear this as just like the Dungshan's Soto style of just keep sitting endlessly. There's no end to sitting. That's maybe a really straightforward meaning, but you could also hear it as kind of like Lin Ji, that we don't ever make Buddhahood or some realization of Dharma into some thing. So therefore, we just keep sitting, and the Dharma is actually complete, and Buddhahood is just, already manifest. So it's not like it's attained. You could even almost hear it like, I mean, that's the character that means like basically attain. So you could say about to attain Buddhahood. This Buddha, who is already a Buddha, he was about to like say, I got it. You could hear it like this too. About to attain it, but he resisted and he just kept sitting. Because he was already Buddha. Mm-hmm. When about to get a hold of it. I think that character can actually mean like kind of to touch or attain or get. Which often has it's the character that we use in Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. It really is this character.
Fulfill one?
Yeah, fulfill. And it really can mean attain. I mean, you could translate that as I vow to attain it, but luckily it's unsurpassable, so it's not something that can be attained, like all those vows, right? But you could. This is just my interpretation here. He's already Buddha, completely Buddha, and he's about to attain it by getting hold of it. But he just sits there for 10 eons without attaining it. Like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with Shanks gone gray, or like a broken, lame tiger, be another translation, and a horse. Literally, this is very strange. The Chinese character there, it's the last one again. It literally means, if you look it up in the Chinese dictionary, a horse with a white left hind leg. And in Thomas Cleary's translation that we used to chant, he translates it that way. Like a horse with a white left hind leg. And he goes, huh? And so probably, and I read somewhere that horses are really big in China. So they have all these characters that have to do with horses, special horses and historical horses. And there's this thing about a dragon horse. I think it appears in the koans at some point. Which is like the horse of some legendary emperor who had this like incredibly fast horse. So I think this is a little bit like lost in obscurity. Whether it means, again, it's one of these things that could mean two opposite things. Like this translator, someone from San Francisco Zen Center, said, like a horse with shanks gone gray, which I think implies, doesn't really mean gray, it's actually white, but maybe same idea, like old, like basically the battle-scarred tiger and the horse with shanks gone gray mean like you're sitting under the tree for so long and you're just kind of withering away and like no problem. That'd be one, that's I think what they try to bring out here. And there's some, you can read in Charlie Bicorni's notes here, there's some Zen phrases that are like referring to this venerable old kind of like, sort of like a fool, like an idiot, kind of like the old realized one who's no longer like really on the ball and like always striving to realize the way, but more just like, huh? Like, in fact, that's where I think this dragon horse comes from, right? I can't remember what koan this is, but something like monk comes to the abbot and says something like, where are all the Buddhas right now? And the teacher says, huh? What? And the monk says, the order was for this flying dragon horse, this special steed, and I just got a lame tortoise. Something like that. And I think it's the same koan within than the abbot goes, my tasks as abbot are many.
What's that?
I might be mixing koans. Do you know if that's the same?
I think that's
how it is. Yeah, my tasks as abbot are many. Like, like, you're so lame. And he's like, well, you know, I have a lot of work to do. And I'm busy. My mind's really distracted because I have all these projects.
Yeah.
So I think that, anyway, that sense of like, and in the koan, it's celebrated. They're like, huh, what? It's like the perfect expression of Buddhahood, right? And the monk, this maybe probably young, gung-ho monk is like, ah, lame answer from the teacher. He's not on the ball. But this kind of dual mirror samadhi is just kind of like resting under the tree. We're not even counting the eons. Like, but, you know, you don't have to ring the bell for Kinyin. 10-eon period is not too long. I'm not keeping track. I'm just withering away here in the dual mirror samadhi. Yeah.
What is that, if you know, that Z-shaped character that's twice in
that? Oh, yeah, it just means like, apostrophe S. It's like possessive, so, yeah. It's like, if you read in reverse, it would be like, of. Yeah, it appears throughout a lot because it's kind of like a proposition. Or one of those little preposition. And I don't, you know, this thing about the white left hind leg, it's a little bit interesting, and maybe this is too esoteric speculation, but it really, if it is white is one of these things in here, right? White is one of the things in the poem. So you could say, I don't know, this is speculation, but like, it's like a black horse, right? It's like almost completely ultimate, but it's got the little bit of its white left hind leg is white. Like that circle, the black circle with the little white bit in there. With like a little bit of ragged relative truth. Always. You know, just disappear into blackness. Mm-hmm.
The horse with shanks gone gray and the battle-scarred tiger reminds me of continuous practice.
Yeah, continuous practice. Yeah, for sure. Not even stopping at 10 eons, actually.
Yeah.
That'd be like, that'd be just a short little practice. Yeah, continuous practice. The dual mirror samadhi never shuts down. It doesn't even need to sleep at night. Because there is the common or the base, vulgar, their dual pedestals, fine clothing, or precious footrests and imperial robes. You could translate it. I'll do these two lines together. Because there is this startlingly different, or because there is the amazing or wonderful, there are house cat and cow, or literally wild cat and white oxen. So it looks like these two lines are like a pair, and they're both referring to other stories. This dual pedestals, fine clothing, probably comes from this Lotus Sutra story, and in this study here, Charlie researched the characters, and they are the same characters in the Lotus Sutra, so it probably is for this jeweled footrest. And the story, it's maybe my favorite story in the Lotus Sutra. Do you know the Lotus Sutra? It's the story of chapter four. Sometimes called the prodigal son. Do you know this story?
I like that story too.
Yeah.
I relate to it.
Yeah. And trying to be somewhat brief, but just the chance to get this story out here, if you haven't heard it, is It's a great story. I think it has a lot. It's a lot about the style of our practice. So there's this. It's a metaphor story. The Buddha tells all these parables. The Lotus Sutra is full of parables. So he's like, there's this wealthy king or somebody who has jeweled footrests and ornate robes, wealthy merchant or king of this town, and he has this one son who, you know, in those days, they will be heir to the throne, right? Naturally. But somehow, one day in the marketplace or something, the son, when he's just a tiny child, wanders off and he gets lost in the bustling market and can't find his dad. Maybe they're even traveling in another town, something like that. So they can't find him and they actually have to just go back home and he's like lost. Meanwhile, this young man is, maybe almost like a baby, like very young. He doesn't even remember his parents. He's just like lost, almost like baby in a town. And of course people in the town find him and, give him something to eat. But he basically, no one really takes him in. He becomes like a destitute wandering beggar, begging from door to door and just a street kid, you know. And meanwhile, his king back in the palace is so sad. He's lost his only son, who'll be heir to the throne. You can picture what this analogy is about, right? It's like the Buddha and us. Yeah, we've wandered off, and so one day, the kid is walking through the town where his father lives, and happens to be walking right by the balcony of the immense palace, and the king up there being fanned by the attendants and sipping pina coladas, Indian pina coladas, he looks familiar. He's a little bit older now, but that's my son. I can't believe he's finally back. Servants, please get him immediately. And the servants go running out in their, high class servant garb to grab the son and bring him back home to give him his true inheritance. And the beggar, meanwhile, sees them coming, and he's so lowly and ragged that he sees these kind of like, maybe they're like, men in black with black sunglasses or something, right? They're like all kind of like the FBI agents. And they're like all dignified looking and they're running towards him. And he's like, oh no, they're coming. I must have done something wrong. I'm just a destitute nobody. I'm probably just, I'm so worthless. And they're finally going to arrest me for trespassing or something. And so he runs. The Buddha's sending his bodhisattvas to come bring back his son, but like even these servants are too much for the son, not to mention the king. He's like, they're too good for me. Yeah, so and then the king's like, so he runs away and they can't catch him. And the king's like, okay, we have to devise some skillful means. The Lotus Sutra, big theme of Lotus Sutra is skillful means. Let's dress up let's dirty up our clothes a little bit. And so we're not so intimidating to this bum. And we'll meet him kind of on his own level. And he'll be more comfortable. So I think they... I forget if he sends the servants or if the king goes himself, puts on rags and goes himself. And they go and say, they don't try to capture him. They say, like, would you like a job? We'll give you some like low paying work, shoveling horse shit, manure in the stables. Well, they don't say the palace, but it's in the palace, right? And he's like, okay, I've never even had any job before, but it's kind of intimidating to even like shovel manure for a job, but okay. So he comes in, he gets to work. It's like, you know, okay, sit upright, follow the breath. We can do over and over, shovel the manure of our life. And then he does, but he's good at it. He's a very diligent worker, shovels the manure well. So they're like, would you like a promotion? Now you can actually just work in the garden. You know, we'll have somebody else shovel the manure and you can like put the manure on the garden. It's like step up, something like this. And so gradually, very gradually, he gets promoted higher and higher. And pretty soon he's like, you know, serving meals in the palace. And then he gets to know the king. He gets less and less intimidated with the king because it's gradual, the gradual approach. And at one point he's basically like just hanging out with the king, you know. He's like his kind of like attendant maybe or something, but he's... They're basically just like they watch TV together, and one day when they're watching TV, the king says, "You know, by the way, there's something I never told you. you know, you're actually my son." And at this point, he's like, "Amazing, unbelievable, but like, it doesn't really freak me out that much. It's like, it's totally cool, but it's like, okay." And he's like, "And the whole palace is yours when I go. In fact, you can take it now." And he's like, "Okay." So look how far he came, right? From this, "Oh, so worthless. My practice is so inferior." To like, "Okay, I'll inherit the kingdom." So you can see. I think it's a great metaphor for our practice. This is how it often goes. It's like gradually this confidence in our true nature, you could maybe say, develops. It's not like the promotion is actually like getting something better. It's the same person, same exact person. But now it's like almost like confidence. He's confident that he is the Buddha's child. Yeah, amazing. I feel like my own practice is you know, very much follows this gradual way. So this line you could hear is, you know, we have this issue of the sudden and gradual in this poem, right? So you could hear that line as the gradual in this very brief reference to the Lotus Sutra. Because there's the base, common people, like this son who had to do this gradual path, common people like that, then there's going to be these precious footrests and imperial clothing that eventually that common person will inherit very gradually. But because there's the amazing, wondrous, startling, their wild cat and cow, you can say this is like the sudden approach. And again, as we said before, neither one's better or worse. It's just that there's these two ways. This gradual, you know, manure shoveling and gradual promotion. And then there's the immediate. And this is like this Book of Serenity, case 69. This koan of, I think the koan is just like, is it Nanchuan, maybe? Just says, it's not even a dialogue. I think he just says, Buddhas and ancestors don't know it. But house, you know, wild cats and white oxen, they know it. I think it's the whole koan. Does that sound familiar? Buddhas and ancestors don't know it. You could say like the jewel mirror, samadhi, or Buddhahood. They don't really know it. But wild cats and white oxen, they know it. You could, like, which maybe very briefly is like... just the wild animals is in their own nature, without, you know, speculating or discriminating about anything. They're just living in the dual mirror samadhi. But Buddhas and ancestors, you know, study all these poems and stuff like that, and then the meaning is not in the words, but they get really into the words, and therefore they don't quite know it directly. But cats and oxen don't have to worry about the word, getting caught in the words.
Does it say house, cat, and cow?
You know, this house, cat, and cow, but...
Oh,
wild cats and white oxen may also come, but they're just a little more wild.
But the possibility I'm thinking of is sort of like more duality of startling versus common.
Oh, that those two are different. That a house cat and a cow are different?
Without one, you don't get the other, you know, because
Because there is, it does have, it has, you know, it's different, but when you put those characters like surprising or amazing together with different as a compound, they mean like wondrous. So whether different is actually meant to be in there or not, is not clear. Literally, it's like, you know, surprising and different, but when you put them as a compound in Chinese, the different kind of disappears, and it just means like startling, maybe different because unusual, like that. So it may not be saying that those two animals are different. It just may maybe mean like there's this in this gradual common approach. There's it's like this, and in this when there is this astonishment or astonishing miraculousness. There are, it says a fox-like animal, wild cat, or raccoon. I don't think house cat.
That's the wrong translation. House cat. House cat's common.
Oh, I see. As if you combine it with the next character, it means cat. So whether it's wild or common. And then white oxen, which of course is in the Lotus Sutra too, and a kind of common Zen thing, right? But white also means plain and common, actually. So, that's interesting. So white ox is not like necessarily like the white Zen ox. It just means like, you could maybe translate it as just a common cat and an ordinary cow. I think that's the meaning of Buddhas and ancestors don't know it, but common cats and common cows, they know it. That's how I take it.
When Catherine gave us her talk for ascending the mountain seat, do you remember she mentioned the cats, the ordinary cats who joined in our practice?
These cats that...
But she must have been referring to this...
Maybe.
thanks to you remembering it, I know.
Ordinary cats practice here. Ordinary cats.
You mentioned something from Dogen recently about, there's nothing special about it. It's just
ordinary mind.
The cats know.
It might have been in Dogen's often quoting this kind of stuff. I can't remember, but it could well be. Yeah. Yeah, it could well be. I think it's not... Yeah, I don't think it's comparing cats and cows. I think it's just saying there's both these kind of... especially in old China, lots of cows around and
I was thinking
cats.
Ordinary versus spectacular, you know, and any of the odds.
Oh, yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. Well, see, yeah, that's the kind of a neat thing, too. Because there's this common, ordinary, there's jewel pedestals, ornate robes. Because there's the miraculous, there's ordinary cats.
Right.
And, yeah.
That's part of the play. These are layers of what
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. Almost like because... Anyway, it's these two sides working together always. Because there's the... For really ordinary being, you need these miraculous, skillful means. For extraordinary beings, it's very ordinary means. You could hear it like that. Yeah. And I think the gradual and sudden is an interesting one, too. The extraordinary sudden method is like totally ordinariness. And the common gradual method involves lots of fancy stuff. Mm-hmm. How about that? Kind of combines it all. So, let's see. Yi with his archer skill could hit a target at 100 paces, but when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? So Yi was one of these ancient archers who always hit the target, famous legendary archer. And the arrow points meet head on, there is this story of about these other archers other than Yi who an archery teacher and his student. And the student started getting better and better at archery until he was like almost the best in the country. And he's like, except my teacher. So, but if I kill my teacher, I'll be the best. So one time he saw his teacher across the field. This is my chance. Shunk! Aimed perfectly at him. And his teacher suddenly turned around. Shunk! Shot the arrow back. And they met and head on and fell to the ground. And then the student submitted. And okay, I'm sorry. I will try it again. Please forgive me. Yeah. Great story.
The only archery story I know, I've heard it said about Colwyn, but it sounds too big.
Oh, yes.
It sounds too big. It sounds like an old...
No, I think this is Colwyn.
You think it's Colwyn?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is my telling of it, is that he just stood on the cliff and pulled the bow and shot an arrow into the void, into the ocean, and yelled, "Bullseye!"
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. An archery workshop at Esalen. So if you've been to Esalen, it's just cliffs over the ocean. I even heard it as, they had a target set up over here and he aimed right at the target and then he turned around to the ocean and let it go. Yeah. So that's it's kinda like arrow points meeting head on actually. Yeah. You can't miss that, the bullseye of the vast ocean. So you could say these lines are about, this skill and refinement in meditation, getting very, refining the meditation to be more and more landing on this moment. But this dual mirror samadhi is like arrow points meeting head on. It's like, it has nothing to do with skill. It's not about refining meditation skill. It's just vast, open awareness, ever present, impossible to lose it. Yeah. It's celebrating this, the naturalness of the dual mirror samadhi. When the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. So I think nothing so special there. It's just, wooden man and stone woman are both Zen images for like non-doing. Like there's all these Zen images like mind like ashes in an ancient incense burner, like moss growing on the lips because you're not speaking, spider webs in your eyebrows from non-blinking, totally like the dead tree practice. Yeah, there's wither away, like make your mind like wood and rock. So that's the classic image that, there's something to just completely let go of any manipulation of anything. Be like a dead person. But there's another side to it. That the wooden man, that one who's just non-doing darkness, can actually sing. That the ultimate can come into the relative and express. And the stone woman, which is, you know, I think in China, barren woman, stone woman means like they can't give birth. I think they actually have that phrase. They can't give birth to anything, any life. But whether it's like that or just literally stone, gets up dancing. Similarly, like that stillness manifesting as dynamic activity, that passive, receptive yin line manifesting outward into the active yang lines in the world.
Mountains walking at all, or is it not just a good?
Yeah. Thing? Yep. Mountains walking. Yep. In fact, in Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra, where he talks about the mountains walking, he brings up this line too. Not from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, but a stone woman gives birth to a child at night. I think it's another Zen saying. I think stone woman gives birth to a child at night. The mountains are constantly walking, I think is the saying. So they're very connected. They're the same saying, yeah. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night in the darkness. The barren woman gives birth in this creative way. So all the same point. So I think woodman and stone woman are the same thing, and singing and dancing are is it the same singing and dancing as up above? Remember there was
inquiry and response.
Yeah.
Inquiry and singing.
Yeah, where was that? Inquiry and response. No, it's different characters.
Same general idea.
Yeah, but generally same idea. Same idea. Mm-hmm. When the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. And it's kind of even more dynamic because it's kind of like almost like interdependence of two emptinesses. The wooden man and stone woman are both like non-existent emptiness. But they are kind of interacting, and that when one's singing, the other one starts dancing. So it's just, you know, really dynamic, wonderful line, I think. Yeah. It's not within reach of feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration and thought? Or it's not within the reach of sentience or consciousness. The character for consciousness. How could it admit of intentional thought? You could translate. Ministers serve their lords. Children obey their parents. So these are these images that, particularly Saoshan, Dongshan's disciple, starts getting into the minister and the lord in particular as a way for talking about these two sides again. The host and the guest. So the ministers serve their lords would be like the relative serves the ultimate. Because the lord just is, right? And the ministers actively function. And children and parents, I think saying is stretching it a little bit, but I think these images are, the parents are just the, like the source. Ooh, they are the source of the children, yeah? And the children that come from that, from the parents, then obey the parents. The children of Buddha then obey the Buddha or go along with the Buddha. So I think they're really just these metaphors here about the relative world serving the ultimate. Or you could say the reflected world is just to serve the jewel mirror. In the end here, we're saying it all returns to the ultimate jewel mirror. Our life is serving the jewel mirror. Not obeying is not filial, and not serving is no help. So just following on the previous line. Practice secretly, working within, like a fool, like an idiot. So practice intimately. You could translate that character Mitsu, practice intimately or secretly. Mikkyo is the esoteric schools of Japanese Buddhism, like Shingon, are called Mikkyo, the secret teaching, but you could say intimate teaching. It's the same character, interestingly, this is the next to last line, that same character is the same one, see at the on the first line, the second from the right, the teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated. It's the same. Now we're saying practice. The teaching's been intimately communicated, and then it's like, here's the communication. And at the very end of the poem, now practice intimately this way, working within like a fool, like an idiot, like a cat or an ox, just wandering around, rubbing on people's legs as they're trying to go in and do this serious work of zazen. Just to continue in this way is called the host within the host. And, I know it's time to stop, but let's read this very last little bit from Dungshan with walking with his uncle Mi, they sometimes called him, his Dharma uncle Mi, saw a vegetable leaf floating down a valley stream when they were walking in the forest. And Dungshan said, if there were no one in these deep mountains, how could there be a vegetable leaf in the stream? Maybe there's a wayfarer, a hermit living in these mountains upstream. So they went upstream. After several miles, they found this emaciated person, Lungshan, Dragon Mountain. And they had this dialogue, which I'll just read the end of it here. Dungshan's kind of like testing him. They find this hermit. They went to testing hermits. make sure that they're not escaping from the world, right? Not just like stuck in the ultimate. What truth have you realized that you come here to dwell on this mountain? Dungshan asked. Lungshan said, I saw two clay bulls fighting and they fell into the ocean, and up till now I have no news of them. I think this, I hear it as the two clay bulls are like these two sides of discrimination, and they're arguing about, is it black or is it white? And they fall into the ocean, they both dissolve. The relative and ultimate dissolve into the great ocean, and there's no more news of anything after this. And then now for the first time, Dungshan bowed with full respect to Lungshan. He liked that response. And then he asked, what's the guest within the host? And Lungshan said, the blue mountain is covered by white clouds. Dungshan said, what's the host within the host? I don't know if he had written this poem first or after. What's the host within the host? Lungshan said, he never goes out the door. Host within the host, he never goes out the door into like some external world of like slings and arrows and, you know, annoying cats and stuff. He just rests in the dual mirror and receives everything. Doesn't need to go out the door because everything's in the door already. The host within the host. Dungshan asked, how far apart are host and guest? Dungshan said, waves on a river. Mm-hmm. Nice. The relative and the ultimate. How far apart are the host and the guest? The relative and the ultimate. Waves on a river. Are they apart or not apart? Dungshan said, when a guest and a host meet, what is said? Lungshan said, the pure breeze sweeps the white moon. Dungshan took his leave and departed.
Pure breeze
sweeps the white moon.
Where's that located?
I think Timeless Spring, Thomas Cleary's Soto collection. When I was practicing in Japan for about a year with Tongen Harada Roshi, because I didn't know Japanese and he basically doesn't know English, we didn't have extensive conversations. But meeting him was very wonderful. Very wonderful to meet. And I think it was like our last Dokusan, like maybe the morning I left or the day before I left. One more Dokusan to say goodbye. And I might have asked something like, do you have any last advice? And his final words to me were, just to continue in this way is called a host within the host. In Japanese. From the dual mirror samadhi. So, what a joy to study the dual mirror with you all. And now we can just practice it endlessly and intimately. Nicely, we have a sesshin in just a couple of days. Just like, be a dual mirror for 5 days or as any time you want. This is a really drop-in sesshin. If you can't come to whole days, you can just like reflect in the dual mirror at any time.
When does it begin?
Begins Wednesday morning. Oh, we dedicate any merit arising from this study of the dual mirror samadhi to all living beings everywhere. May they rest joyfully at ease in the precious mirror awareness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.